Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Purdy Insurance. Visit Purdy Insurance on Market Street in Sunbury or visit online at purdyinsurance.com. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Man, today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. I'm in the Sunbury Motor Studio, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. A couple quick Olympic notes for you, then we'll get to Nate Mink from Syracuse.com on Jim Boeheim. Michaela Schifrin, along with Lindsey Vonn, about as successful a women's winter season as you could possibly have, both winning World Cups. And Missy Franklin, who had a great London Olympics with four golds, capped off her University of California career by leading them to the national championship. She'll turn 20 in May. She has decided to now turn pro and has signed with IMG. She did help Cal win the national championship, closing out a career by winning the 200-yard individual medley, 200 backstroke, 200 freestyle this past weekend in North Carolina. She swam the winning 800 free relay, and then they finished in second place in the 400 free relay for the Cal Bears, so she has decided to turn pro. And Missy Franklin enjoyed her 2 years. She's done exactly what she said she would do. She said she wanted to go to college for 2 years at minimum. She has, and of course, is coming up in, 16 months. All right, we bring in Nate Mink, Syracuse.com, to discuss Jim Boeheim. Nate, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Steve. It's always good to be back on with you guys.
All right, let's start with the violations at Syracuse. What were more egregious? Anything that happened?
Oh, without question, the basketball program, and that's reflected in the report that the NCAA issued and also in the sanctions that the NCAA levied on the school. You know, as it pertains to football, you know, it certainly, you know, no violations are good, but, you know, in the context of the whole scandal, you know, they were certainly mitigating. They were limited to just basically no-show internships or falsifying internship hours at a YMCA where football players would still get, you know, full academic credit in a course that they needed to graduate. Basketball, you kind of have the run of the gamut there. You have failure to adhere to their drug policy. You have some implications with a booster from the Y who also was involved with a couple football players also. But you know, without question, the big one is the academic fraud as it relates to Fab Mello in particular, the former you know, Big East Defensive Player of the Year and NBA pick who played here, I believe, most recently in 2012. You know, the report goes on in great detail about kind of the steps the university took to keep him eligible during that 2012 season. That Syracuse, obviously, they positioned themselves for a national title run. You know, I think they put up an extraordinary Big East record. They were number one seed in the NCAA tournament. They were a real favorite to get to the Final Four that year and win a national title. And Mello was suspended in the middle of that season due to an academic infraction. And then the university really, you know, brainstormed how they could get him back on the court. And, you know, they pursued a grade change from a previous course that Mello passed a year ago. They eventually got him back on the court before the postseason, but then, you know, the school discovered that there was an issue in just how, you know, that paper actually came to be written, and that's when they pulled them out before the NCAA tournament, and obviously then the NCAA, which had already been, you know, keeping a close eye on Syracuse, really took a closer look at Syracuse, and I think that was, in their mind, the most egregious violation in the whole episode.
The reason I asked that question to lead off is that Jim Boeheim essentially took the football program at one point in the press conference and threw it under the bus, and that's why I asked the question. What were your thoughts on what was a very interesting roadmap of a press conference for 45 minutes on Thursday.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people's ears perked up when Boeheim made those comments about the football program. It's interesting. I think the larger point he was trying to make there was just how inconsistent the NCAA doles out punishments, not just from institution to institution, but even doling out punishments within each institution. Jim's an avid supporter of every sport at Syracuse. I mean, it's really remarkable. He'll be at lacrosse games, men and women. He'll be at soccer games, men and women. He'll be at every football game, sitting in the AD's box next to the press box. I mean, there is literally no bigger Syracuse sports fan in this town than Jim Boeheim. But, you know, I think he kind of feels, and no one has really come out and said this explicitly, but you kind of get the sense that there's an undertone that Jim was targeted here by the NCAA, what those motivations were. You know, no one can really quite want to say. It would be kind of speculative to go there.
Sure.
But, you know, he kind of felt that he was maybe unduly punished a little bit here when obviously – and the other thing to his point, I think, is the whole thing kind of kicked off. The whole NCAA investigation and Syracuse's own internal investigation jump-started because of – violations in the football program as it related to the internship and actually as it related to that booster at the YMCA who was paying some football players for more or less volunteer work at the Y that the school and the YMCA didn't really have official documentation of that was actually legitimate work.
All right, so he goes out and he wants to fight this. What were your thoughts on his reasoning behind fighting it and appealing it the way he did on a personal level?
I think it was typical Jim, the way he was defiant in his press conference. I mean, he went through the report and each allegation step by step and either owned up to it or refuted it. A lot of it was refuting. There was a couple things that he owned up to, such as, you know, the drug policy. But... you know, as it relates to his case, it's tough. You know, I think once the NCAA kind of comes out with their ruling and kind of dig their heels in, it's really, really tough to get such a ruling overturned. Obviously, you know, it's not impossible, as you guys have seen that to be the case. But you know, the reasons, his main argument, I guess, at the end of the day, is that the NCAA has essentially accused him of failure to monitor his program and not basically advocating for an atmosphere of compliance. His main argument that he kind of outlined on Thursday and what we presume to be his main argument when they actually go through the official appeal process will be that, you know, he regularly holds compliance meetings with staffs. You know, there's a general ongoing dialogue with how to report violations and how to be in compliance with NCAA rules. And, you know, to me, it's just going to be tough for the NCAA to renege on their ruling significantly because, you know, he essentially had a chance to rebut their accusations against him at a hearing in Chicago, and the NCAA, you know, just flat out refused to listen to it or noted it and continued to punish as they wanted to punish anyway.
All right, so now we get to a couple of scenarios here. One, he knew about it, which is bad. Or here's another one that he didn't know about it, and basketball programs are not as encompassing numbers-wise as football programs. Not knowing about it or hearing about it also is not very good. What were your thoughts on those two scenarios? One, bad that he knew about it, but two, bad that he didn't know about it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with your, you know, assessment there that it does not look good in either scenario, which is why I think, you know, some level of punishment was warranted here. At the same time, I think you just have to, in this case, you know, you have to kind of just take people at their word mm-hmm. until there is evidence that proves contrary. You know, a lot of people have made the point that, not just in this case, but over the years, that Jim delegates responsibility and trust people in position of power within his organization to do the job. He runs his program much like, you know, a pro organization in that respect, mm-hmm. in that he's not a micromanager. He's just going to, you know, he's going to give you a job, or you're expected to do a job, and he kind of expects you to do it the right way, or just by any means necessary, you know, get the job done.
Right.
You know, I think in the case, you know, obviously the big issue here with the, regarding Fab Mello, you know, he hired the director of basketball operations, Dan Kissel, to clean up, you know, academics. You know, he is, and this is coming from the report, he was not happy with the team's academic progress prior to hiring Stan Kissel, I believe, around 2007. And, you know, when the Fab issue arose and the school, you know, pursued a grade change, which was within university policy, which was an option open to any student, you know, there was just kind of a natural assumption that Stan was going to, you know, take care of the issue. And Jim, you know, just whether it's a fault or not, just trusted his guy to get the job done. And obviously at the end of the day, you know, there was proven to be revisions with a course paper that the director of basketball ops and another, you know, basketball staffer, a former receptionist, made revisions to a paper that ultimately was turned in for the grade change. And you know, that was, I think, the thing that, you know, drew the NCAA's ire there, is that, you know, and, you know, the other point is, you know, I think, you know, Jim was down this road, you know, 20 years ago.
Yes.
You know, his program was sanctioned in 92, was issued a postseason ban for, you know, really a wide-ranging gamut of allegations back then, too. So, you know, I think there might be a level of expectation in the NCAA's eyes, even though a lot of the people in power at that place were not there in 92. There was kind of that precedent set that, okay, you know, you kind of got caught and you kind of pleaded, you know, the fifth, so to speak, back in 92. You know, now in 2014, 2015, you should have a lot more knowledge of the kinds of things you should be aware of and you know, monitoring within your program.
There certainly are too many assumptions made about how anybody in the leadership position should handle things. I mean, there's always those assumptions because there aren't many people out there that are, quote, in leadership positions to begin with. Even micromanaging, you're still going to have things fall through the cracks when there's you still have to trust somebody to do the job that you put out. Now, here's my next question. I know he's 70 years old, so this is a different angle on this. But he has done great things, Jim Boeheim, in the Coaches Versus Cancer movement, which I've talked about on the show. He's done great things in conjunction with Mike Krzyzewski with USA Basketball, which is tremendous. But also working USA Basketball takes a lot of time. Has that something that's been brought up that he's had maybe too much time away from campus?
No, that angle has not been brought up really to any extent through this. You know, he's like you said, he's very involved in a lot of things, but he's still there's, I think in the NCAA's mind, there's still an expectation level there that you should be generally aware of what, you know, your staff is doing. I know. And you made the analogy earlier to football. You know, the football has a roster size in some cases seven times as large as basketball. You know, there's three times as many more assistant coaches. Football has a lot more just lower level support staffers running around the mill. I mean, this was Jim's director of basketball operation that stepped out of line. This is one of the guys he's perceived to work pretty closely with within the structure of his program. So I think that, you know, that is the relationship, and that is the position that has been found, and of committing NCAA violations was really the thing that triggered, you know, the whole head coaching responsibility, by law, and why you saw Jim get hit with, you know, significant penalties, such as the 9-game suspension and the vacation of all the wins and things like that, rather than just, scholarship reductions and a financial penalty and other punitive actions taken against the institution.
Nate, I know idealistically Jim Boeheim would like Mike Hopkins to be the next head basketball coach at Syracuse. When it does come to pass as to whenever he leaves, next year or his stated 3 years, what are the odds, in your opinion, that Mike Hopkins actually is the next head basketball coach at Syracuse?
That was actually one of the predominant storylines when Jim first announced his kind of 3-year time frame for retirement. That's the number one question everyone wanted to know. What does this mean for Mike Hopkins? You know, there was rumors about whether or not there was actually a contract between Hop and the university that stipulated that he would be the next coach when Jim left. Ultimately, I think this is going to be a decision that's going to come down to the chancellor, who's only been there for a year, and the man or woman that the chancellor happens to be the new AD. I mean, those are the two people who are ultimately going to make the decision. You know, Jim has advocated for Mike. Mike's obviously been a longtime assistant. You know, as far as we know right now, he has really no ties to this investigation. Now, that doesn't mean anything right. can come out down the road. But right now, he's very well thought of in the community. He's obviously an ace recruiter on his staff. He's one of the most highly regarded assistant coaches. You know, I think that he kind of sees now that there is light at the end of the tunnel, that there is an end game here, that it is going to be at the very most 3 years before he gets a chance to maybe have a real shot at this job. I think that will encourage him to stay more so than go looking for another job. But, you know, Hop's turned down head coaching opportunities before. You know, he had a chance to go to Charlotte yep. a number of years ago, USC. He was a finalist for, I believe, Boston College most recently. Took a pretty hard look at him. So he's, I think, going to be continuing to be kind of a hot commodity when some of these head coaching jobs come open. But, you know, obviously he played for Boeheim. He was a team captain here. He met his wife here. He's raised a family here. He has a lot of roots down in this community that I think it's going to take a very, very, very special opportunity for him to leave Syracuse. And now that he kind of knows, and I know I'm kind of repeating myself, but now that he kind of knows that there is a, you know, for lack of a better term, expiration date on Jim's coaching career, you know, that may make it a little bit more difficult to leave.
One final question. What level of concern is there, Nate, in the Syracuse community and quietly in the administration that they can sustain Syracuse's level of excellence while playing in the ACC and in a 30-plus thousand-seat building without Jim Boeheim running it?
Yeah, you know, I think all the parts are still in place. Like you mentioned, they still have a 30,000-seat stadium. You know, that's a selling point. You know, I don't think the brand of Syracuse basketball, as is the case when a lot of these programs, high-profile programs, go through the infractions process, I don't think the brand really gets damaged so much as, you know, and it kind of hurts to say this, but, you know, the current players from this year's team really felt perhaps the brunt of the penalties by getting, you know, denied a postseason opportunity.
Sure.
You know, certainly in the short term, there's going to be challenges with the scholarship reductions. You know, basketball, I think, is a little bit different in terms of the impact on the court because of scholarship reductions as opposed to football, just because, you know, not to say, you know, losing three scholarships over 4 years isn't going to hurt, but, you know, you can get by as long as you're really, really good at, you know, recruiting and kind of scouting and that kind of thing. But, you know, I think this is still going to be an attractive job. You know, like, I know, you know, Mike Hopkins, who, you know, if as renowned as he is around the country, is going to be interested in the job. I don't think you're going to have a shortage of candidates be interested in it. And then, you know, once you have the new guy take over, it's going to be, you know, in many ways much like it was, I would assume, when Bill O'Brien kind of took over permanently for Joe Paterno. You know, you're still going to have the fan support, you're still going to have the stadium, you know, you're still going to have the financial support there. Everything's going to be in place. It's just going to ultimately come down to the coach to bring in his players and win games.
Nate, it is always a pleasure. Thanks for reconnecting with us and for giving us some very insightful answers that maybe a lot of people around here didn't know about the Syracuse situation.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone there cares about Syracuse.
No, this has been a major topic here. It's been a major topic in part because, with all due respect, but Jim made a rather offhand comment about Joe a couple of years ago
that did
not go over very well here, thus his situation here has drawn a lot of interest, in part because of that offhand comment, which I don't know whether you regret or not.
Obviously it's in conjunction with the Bernie Fine situation,
right?
I think he's That has not come up recently, but I think he's moved on from that.
Oh, yeah, no, I think he's moved on from that, but I'm saying the fact that he made the comment about Joe has people interested in his situation here. That's the,
right.
All right. Nate, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you, Steve. See you.
Nate Mink, Syracuse.com. Bottom of the hour. News update. Today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. And we're in the Sunbury Motors studio, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 to 15, Hummel's Wharf on News Radio 1070 WKOK. All right, bottom of the hour news, then an open line at 800-795-9565. We've covered a lot of ground today, everything from the Syracuse situation. But first, news as we head to the bottom of the hour. Today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. I'm in the Sunbury Motors studio, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. It's amazing how and what a tremendous coincidence that the Purdy family is so deeply involved in the insurance business while running a golf tournament where Kevin causes you to buy insurance. Unbelievable.
Did you just do an Olympic stuff like in the last half hour, or was I hallucinating?
I did it in such a way that was palatable to the show in bullet point form. Extensive conversation not needed.
Hey, guess what day it is?
Tuesday?
No, it's Hyundai.
Hyundai!
Remember, every day is Hyundai?
Hyundai!
And it's the Lease We Can Do sales event going on now at Sunbury Motors Hyundai.
Hyundai!
The Lease We Can Do is cut the crap and give you low payments and no money down. Lease a 2015 Hyundai Sonata SE for only $237 a month for 36 months with zero down. Zilch. Nada. Or lease a 2015 Hyundai Elantra SE for only $183 a month for 36 months. Again, no money down. Or you could go green. Lease a 2015 Hyundai Sonata Hybrid for $250 a month for 36 months, and you guessed it, zero due at signing. No hidden fees, no plus tax, and blah, blah, blah. It's the lease we can do. These cars are here, these deals are real, and they're only at your home for Hyundai, Sunbury Motors Hyundai,
Hyundai.
In the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, where every day is Hyundai.
Hyundai!
Lease is based on 10,000 miles per year, zero total due at signing with approved HMFR Tier 1 financing, tax included. See dealer for complete details.
You just don't think about insurance. You buy a home, you take out a policy, and you forget about it until something happens and you need it. Then you think about insurance a lot. My agent recommended insurance from Selective. Insurance for our home and property, jewelry, even the food in our refrigerator. Selective thinks about everything, so I don't have to.
Selective. Response is everything. Get to know us at Selective.com.
Get to know your local Selective agent, Purdy Insurance, on Market Street in Sunbury or at PurdyInsurance.com. Find out what Purdy Insurance can do for you.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury, taking care of all of your insurance needs. And they'll make sure that you're getting the right coverage for exactly the right price. It's all at Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. They are the insurance professionals. I'm in the Sunbury Motors studio, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Our number 800-795-9565. Our thanks to Bob Buhner talking about the Bloomsburg Twitter situation and the class, by the way, of Monet Davis, the 13-year-old, saying that she doesn't want him removed from the team, and Bloomsburg's made its decision. And very tough for them to go back on it because they've made a strong decision. And also, Nate Mink from StateCollege.com talking about the Syracuse situation. Look, we expect there aren't a lot of people that are, quote, in leadership positions. Some delegate, some micromanage. Everybody has their own leadership style. either way, even in micromanagement, you still have to have a level of trust of what you're micromanaging. And you're hoping that you're hiring dedicated professionals. Now, let's take, for example, the director of basketball operations at Syracuse. Here's the part that I have trouble reconciling. What is the goal of every director of basketball operations? Every single one of them. What's their goal? Every single one of them has the goal of being a head coach. Every one of them. There isn't one director of basketball operations out there that doesn't want to be a head coach. Well, wouldn't you want to put together a really rock-solid resume of dependability, of trust, and loyalty, but also someone that does it right, so that when the time comes to be an assistant coach and make the next step up the ladder, that's the reputation you have? So when I look at the Syracuse situation, leadership is difficult, but that's why you're a leader. Let's take, for example, and leadership comes in all forms. Take, for example, the people of Bloomsburg, the baseball coach, the athletic director, and the university president all had to make a decision on a player. They acted swiftly, and they did what Oklahoma did with the fraternity 2 weeks ago. And the video that they put out. In that case, same story. University acted quickly. That happened to be YouTube. This happened to be Twitter. And as for Jim Boeheim, if this evidently is going on behind his back and he's having regular meetings about it, then there's a major disconnect here. It's a guy he hired in 2007. He didn't hire him in 2012. Now, my question is, why is he still the director of basketball operations from 2007? Don't you want to move up and out? I'm just throwing that out there. I mean, they all want to be coaches. This guy's been the Dobo since 2007? Really? Okay. Every director of basketball operations I've been around has had a lot of higher aspirations than that. So at least I may have given you some answers about what's going on there with that program. The NCAA basketball tournament, once they get to the round of 32, I find no surprises. Because they're just numbers on a board, that the gap in talent closes dramatically. Then NC State, for example, they pulled, quote, the big upset of the weekend. Well, up to a point. They have three guards that can absolutely compete with Villanova. They played a really smart game. Their inside game is better than Villanova's. It's one of the reasons why a lot of people talk about Patrick Chambers. Oh, he wants to have the program look like Villanova's. Not completely. Pat's talked to me several times about how he changed his mind dramatically after being through the Big Ten about the, you know, what an inside game means. He said the Big Ten had so many physical big men. He said, look, what Villanova does is not going to work in the Big Ten. He knows that. He's talked to me about that.
Wisconsin's a good example.
Yeah, they're a good example. They're long. They're athletic. But you know what? It's interesting. Wisconsin is what Villanova wants to be, where all five guys can shoot the three. Now that Nigel Hayes can shoot it, Wisconsin has five guys on the floor. Even when they bring Duye Dukin in, everybody can shoot the three. But they're very long across the front. Very long. I mean, Decker's 6'10". Kaminsky's 7 feet tall. Nigel Hayes is 6'7", 6'8". Yet they all can pop out, and you look at Decker, he's a really athletic 6'10". Really athletic. And we'll see what they do in the next round. But again, notice how Oregon fought Wisconsin to the end. Well, again, you're saying, well, it's a 1-8. It doesn't matter if it's a 1-8. Once you get to the second round, the gap closes dramatically. Now you're going to have West Virginia, for example, play Kentucky. I think West Virginia has a legitimate shot in the game because the Harrison twins have shown over time that they have a tendency to try to impose their will and play your game. Which is why, for example, John Calipari benches them from time to time. Because they have a tendency to still play an immature game. And that's where West Virginia's got a chance. Now, the problem West Virginia has is normally West Virginia doesn't shoot the ball that well. Matt Brown won the national championship in wrestling in a really odd, odd circumstance. It looked like he was on the verge of winning. And then he put himself on the verge of losing. And then it ended with just about interlocking hands on a hold. And they had to go to a replay, and they determined it was true, and Brown was awarded a point in the championship.
Wow. I didn't realize that he had to go to review.
Yes, they had, and he had a great line. He says, you always envision winning the national championship, he said, like hitting a grand slam in the bottom of the ninth inning. He said, I did it with a bunt single.
That is a good analogy. That's good. That's real good.
But he still won it. And give Matt Brown a lot of credit. He had to fight through a very tough bracket to get there, a rather deep bracket to get there. And he won the national title. Penn State finished sixth overall. I know you almost fainted when I did an Olympic story.
I was trying to see if it was, you know, an Olympic year. I thought maybe I missed something somewhere.
It's not, but, of course, quick poll. Nobody knew who Missy Franklin was, but I explained it.
I knew who Missy Franklin was.
And that, again, means you're out of the mainstream.
I've never argued that fact with you, have I?
I held it in the 2015 season.
That was a dumb rule that really hasn't played into effect in a couple of years.
It has not. There were only two blackouts in 2014, no blackouts. There were only two blackouts in 2013, no blackouts in 2014. The policy stipulates that a home game must be sold out 72 hours in advance in order to be televised locally. So that's off the boards. Dick in Milton joins us. Hi, Dick. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Steve. Hey, I just wanted to. I heard you mention Matt Brown. I was at the Scott Trade Center for the wrestling, NCAA wrestling. I just wanted to make three comments. First of all,
I bet that was dramatic. Oh.
What's that?
He won.
Well, he did win, and it was somewhat controversial. There was a couple controversial things that happened out there. And my only thing about it is, you know, ESPN had lots of coverage on for wrestling. They have to rethink how they do this because a wrestling event, which is basically 7 or 10 7-minute matches, takes 3 hours on ESPN the way they do it out there. And I don't know how they'll keep fans' interest watching on television and aren't big wrestling fans. It's not the WWE. This is college wrestling. I know they want to pay for the event.
They pay up to a point. It's very minimal. They really, the NCAA Wrestling Championships, they're not exactly putting it out for bid. There's not many people bidding on it.
I understand that, but I just, you know, as much as I like the wrestling and the basketball and all this stuff, I just think that somehow they have to. They can't have an event that should take it 2 hours at the most, take 3 hours. I guess that's my point.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you, Dick.
And I'm one of the people sitting in the audience for 3 hours waiting for it to happen to be completed.
How much dead time did you experience while they went through all of this?
Well, I'll tell you what. Well, we didn't have much. We didn't have as much on the finals because they were giving out awards between the matches.
Okay.
But let me tell you a little story real quickly. On the first night, the second night, obviously, the Friday night, where they do the semis in the middle and the consolations. Yeah. They actually did 10 semifinal matches on two mats. And went through two rounds of consolations on the outside mats in the same amount of time. That was my point. They took a 4-minute and 45-second break between each of the semifinals, 4 minutes and 45 seconds, and in the middle of that, they took a 9-minute break, just a break. And that's my point. You don't see that on television. That's a long time if you think about it.
Yes, I know it takes a long, long time. When you're sitting there, that's why I emphasize to my students in class, if I have dead air for 5 seconds, it seems like an eternity. 4 minutes and 45 seconds of dead time must seem like 4 hours.
For 10 matches, basically 10 between each semifinal match. But it's pretty obvious when you can do two series of 10 matches on the consolation matches at the same amount of time it takes you to do the semis in the middle. That's the difference. The other thing I wanted to sometime ask Bob Buhner this, and I was not caught until the basically caught because I didn't even know it was a stipulation. One of the stipulations at the Scott Trade Center is no recording and audio devices. So basically, I go in every day with my iPad. It's a mini iPad, and I was not caught until the third day, and then they wouldn't let me in, and I had to kind of like sneak it in to get by. Then I didn't bring it back. But there's 16,000 people sitting around with the damn iPhone, and I just looked it up, and the best one of the best audio recording devices is the iPhone. So how ask Bob Buhner that? How technically, what's the difference in any sense to me?
There isn't, except that probably because you can use your phone as a phone. That's probably the reason you can get, because it's so difficult to differentiate between the use of a phone and using it as a recording device.
Well, it just says it says no audio and recording. Plus, you can take photos with you. You can take the same damn things with a phone that you can do. I just think that it's kind of absurd. That's my only point. Because most people, in fact, out of the 18,000 people, maybe 1,000 people went in there with an iPad or 500 or 800, but the other 17,000, most of them had a phone. That they think they should be allowed in there, and I don't think it would have been. It wasn't distracting. I didn't even use it as a camera or a phone. I used it to follow the matches on. That's all.
No, you know. Here's the issue. The issue has to do with rights, and we talked about ESPN. They still pay a right. I think what ESPN pays is a complete encompassing rights fee for NCAA championships, and wrestling happens to be one of them. But they also gives them exclusive right to video, which gives them the exclusive right to sell the video. For example, say you wanted a DVD of the championship. Well, it would be through NCAA Productions that you would get that video. You could go in there, for example, with an iPad, and you could put it together and maybe put together your own video. Well, you're not really allowed to do that, and the same thing with audio, because there are several radio stations across the country, including one here in State College, that goes in and they do play-by-play of it. Well, each one of them pays a rights fee to do it. So now you're in there and you could do your own audio if you want, and that's why they don't want you doing that. You can do your own video and you can sell that bootleg copy of your own DVD as opposed to the official one, and I think that's what they're, quote, trying to crack down on. Now, whether the efficiency of a phone to do that versus an iPad in the total package I just talked about, especially in the editing part of it, an iPad you can edit with.
Right, I understand
and
all
that. And a phone is not, you can't really edit with a phone. And I think that's the reason why I do. And you and I both know what you were doing was just completely innocent. You just wanted to have it for your own personal keepsake.
Right.
Not everybody goes in with the same mindset, Dick, that you do. I'm going to get some of this. I'm going to sell it to my other fans. I'm going to make some money.
Well, I guess my only point was, like, on the Penn State Mat site, you can follow right along on the matches and everything. It's right up to the second, the brackets, blah, 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 blah. And that's the only thing I ever did with the damn thing the whole time I was there for the first 2 days. And then I didn't take it back after they told me I couldn't have it in there. I just think it's kind of discriminating in a sense when I'm looking around me and everybody, people are filming the thing with their phones, they're listening, they're doing all this stuff, and I'm sitting there because I can't do it. I got to use a damn piece of paper if I want to do it the rest of my time, and I didn't even do that. It just kind of irritates the devil out of me in that sense. I mean, I guess they have the right to do anything they like in there, but that's the way it is. I wasn't real thrilled about it, I guess.
Here's the lesson in all of that. Next year, just use your phone.
Well, I don't have, you know, with my iPad, because of the way I use it, I don't have a cell phone. I don't have an iPhone. You know, I've got enough money invested in my iPhone with my data stream and everything. So I don't really want a phone on top of that, you know. I don't want anybody to call me on there. Anyhow, make a long story. But the wrestling was good, and I wanted to. My last comment is, they put the kids at the afterwards. We went to the, and it was excellent. The after session thing with the Penn State mixer, I'll call it a mixer, and the wrestlers came over. And Kale Sanderson has really relaxed. Where he used to give you 30 seconds of a speech to get up in front of people, he did 4 or 5 minutes this time, which I thought was kind of neat. He's actually relaxed a lot more in front of a crowd like that. Which is kind of
I've noticed that in interviews with him, that I know with me, every time I talk to him, he now acts like he's talking to me and he's not thinking about all of his answers.
Yeah, I understand that. And that wasn't meant to be critical of the way it used to be. That's just
everybody relaxes, Dick, after a period of time once you get used to doing something. And everybody relaxes and they find their own comfort zone. Kurt Warner was a great example when he was here. When he was a sophomore here and he was allowed to be interviewed, he'd give you like 10, 15 seconds, maybe 8, 9 seconds. By the time he was a senior, Dick, he was talking in paragraphs. Just comfort.
But it was excellent. It really was. It was excellent. We had the local kids. Bucknell had 4 kids there. And then you also had the Spencer Myers from Seals Grove and Ryan Solomon from Milton wrestling for Pitt in Maryland. So it was kind of neat. There was other kids, you know, not just your kids from middle of nowhere who you don't even know from wrestling, but kids.
Yeah, Mitchell Port up at Edinburgh's from Delphine, you know. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and it was kind of neat. It was excellent. It's very well run in the sense that, you know, the wrestling part of it's well run. How it is on television, of course, I don't see it there because I'm sitting in the thing and watching it. But anyhow, Penn State wrestlers did well. They'll be better next year. I just wanted to make that point. They're going to be very good. You know,
great.
And it's a big time sport.
Yep. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. We will come back, wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. All right, wrapping up for today, our thanks to Bob Buhner for joining us on the show today to talk about the situation at Bloomsburg and that incredibly ignorant tweet that was put out. And also to Nate Mink of Syracuse.com, discussing in depth and detail the situation with Jim Boeheim at Syracuse.